wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say I'm loud, say I'm clear for the whole.
Good morning and welcome to Voices from the Front Lines, your national movement building show. This is Channing Martinez, your co-host. I'm on the air with Eric Mann. How are you doing, Eric?
Good morning, Channing.
Good morning. Today we have a pretty exciting show. As you know, last week we did this great film showing of Americond, a film about the Amazon Labor Union. And we did it at Strategy and so on, had a lot of wonderful guests, including Chris Smalls and Sean Claffey. And as I mentioned on last week's show, we heard the first half of Marcy Winograd and Eric Mann on this article on Palestine, taking away the funds from the United States and taking away resources that are fueling, you know, Zionism and Israel. So this week, we have a continuation of that show. We have two things on deck. First of all, as promised, you're going to hear the second part of this conversation with Eric and Marcy. And then second, we are going to play some clips from the panel of the film showing of Americond with Eric Mann, Akuna Uka, and Chris Smalls. And with that, I'm going to pass it on to Eric to do the first part.
So good morning, everybody. Welcome to Voices of the Front Lines. I was re-listening to the audio of the conversation with Marcy Winograd and myself, and just so lucky to have it because, you know, sometimes in the movement, it comes down to who likes somebody. I mean, besides all the other things about respect. So Marcy and I have just liked each other for a very long time. She ran for Congress, and she's the head of the Code Pink Congress. And she wrote this article in Counterpunch on February 21st called "How Nations Can End Israeli Genocide, Stop the Weapons, Stop the Oil, and Stop the Tech." So, in the part two of it, we're starting to discuss, you hear my voice first, but it's sort of like just the beginning of a particular break in the conversation. When Marcy and I are talking about this abandoned Biden tactic for the anti-war movement and in support of the people of Palestine, most of course it'll speak for itself, but several thoughts. Historically, there's been a lot of people, I'll say, among me, what does that mean? Including me, who was under great pain, have said, as bad as the Democrats are, we have to defeat, for instance, Donald Trump. I'm not even saying, as I say, in the last moment, that may be true or may not be true. But what Marcy and I are saying right now is the central question is not who's going to get elected in 2024. But the existing president of the United States is committing genocide against the people of Palestine, the people of Gaza. That's the issue right now. But the interesting thing, because others have been involved in the so-called abandoned Biden campaign, is we just had the primaries, Democratic primaries. And what's interesting is, of course, is that mainly, with a few exceptions, Joe Biden is running against himself. But check this out. In Michigan, and Marcy talks about, 100,000 people voted uncommitted. In North Carolina, 88,000 people voted uncommitted. In Minnesota, 46,000 people voted uncommitted. What does that mean? It means that a lot of people waking up in the morning, Democrats, and saying, I do not want Joe Biden, number one, because he's carrying out war crimes, and number two, I do think he's going to lose to Donald Trump. So interestingly, that even the people that are focusing on Palestine are also trying to say, and Marcy has the idea that even at the Democratic Convention, which is probably in July, we still may think that there'll be the possibility of Michelle Obama or somebody where the inside of the Democratic Party says, this guy is unelectable, and right now they're in panic. So with that, we're going to listen to Marcy Winograd and Eric Mann. Also, finally, you'll listen to Marcy talk about that there are 30 people from Code Pink in D.C., including the co-chairs Medea Benjamin and Jody Evans. And Code Pink is pretty relentless, ferocious, fierce, and they're running around Washington, whether people want to or not, forcing these elected officials to at least address that they're taking money from the American Israel Political Action Committee. So with that, we'll listen to Eric Mann and Marcy Winograd, or more importantly, Marcy Winograd. I read an article by a guy named Michael and Sarah, who I'd known in SDS for a long time, saying how in 1968 did we not vote for Humphrey and not see the danger of Nixon. I'm saying because it was Humphrey carrying out genocide against the people of Vietnam. And if you're an anti-genocide movement, right now, that's who's running. Of course, we want Nixon to win, but we did not see it the same. You know, and we saw Humphrey and Johnson as the war criminals. So today, you have Biden wanted a three-part resolution. One, changing the border restrictions. Two, more aid for the Ukraine. And three, more aid for Israel. And you want to talk about Trump? I mean, can you ever, ever just stay with Biden for a while? You know, the fact that we've called him Genocide Joe, which is one of the great victories of the movement, is so successful that Van Jones, an old friend of mine who's, you know, now a commentator on CNN, said, well, Genocide Joe's going to have a problem in the election. And he's an arch, you know, defender of the Democratic Party. But the point is, he just incorporated Genocide Joe into almost like that's his name. I would argue if you agree that's his name, and you then want to talk about how to elect him, I got a problem.
It's crazy. So, I don't think people realize that historically, Lyndon Johnson, he bowed out when his approval rating was at 36%. Biden is at 37%. Right. Okay. He will lose this election if he stays in. He will lose to Trump.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Well,
I mean, so I think the one dynamic I keep thinking about, though, is March 5th is only the primary. It's not like he's running against Trump on March 5th. He's running against Trump in November is what I understand, right? And so it means that, so what if you don't vote for Biden in March?
Well, it's a barometer.
I think, right? Is that, am I understanding that right?
I think it's a, you know, it's a barometer, and it says people don't want you, and they may stay home. You know, and that may be the biggest threat, that they stay home and they sit on the couch and they don't go to the polls. At some point, the DNC is going to have to decide, and it could be at the convention, that this guy is a loser. And drop him.
I see.
You know, and drop him.
So staying with what you're saying, Jenny, these are the primaries.
And yeah.
Normally, a president's not even in the primary. He's
right.
Just reelected. So the fact that the people running against them, that there's a no vote against him, an enthusiastic no vote. How many did you say were, tell me again, the votes?
100,000 in Michigan voted uncommitted. That's 13%.
And well, that's astounding, because when Channing got 2,500 votes, is that right? Yeah, you're
yeah.
Wrong?
Yeah, yeah.
When Channing ran for city council and got 2,500 votes, we knew that was phenomenal. I mean, 2,500 people woke up in the morning and did not vote for Mark Ridley Thomas, did not vote for Grace Hugh. They choose this guy, Jenny Martinez. Imagine 100,000 human beings getting up in the morning to vote no on Joe Biden.
Wow.
It's phenomenally important. And,
Yes.
right? So I'm just building on your point. I wanted to send it back to you, Marcy.
Yeah.
The
And
question,
I have
what
to
we're
say,
trying to say is we want to create destabilization inside the Democratic Party where we don't know what's going to happen, but cause enough chaos that they cannot just keep saying Trump, Trump, Trump. And somebody may have to show up as the peace candidate or even force Biden to something. So the more unloyal, disloyal you are right now, along with his low approval rating, you know, I want to write a Joe Biden is not too old to be tried as a war criminal. Joe Biden is not too old
to commit genocide.
To commit a genocide. Right. So stop all this crap about his age. The point is what he's doing. So back to
exactly.
You.
Exactly. And he's still doing it.
He's
you
still
know,
doing
people,
it.
People want to believe the best. They do. Oh, he tells us he doesn't want to harm the civilians. He's concerned. He doesn't like what Netanyahu's doing. Oh, come on. Let's look at what he's really doing. What he's doing is pushing Congress to pass, as you mentioned, that $95 billion supplemental with $14.3 billion for Israel, $61 billion for Ukraine, and $8 billion to further militarize East Asia for a war with China. What else is he doing? Oh, he is probably very frustrated because that supplemental has yet to hit the House floor. You mentioned it passed the Senate, but there's all sorts of dysfunction in the House, you know, that's controlled by the Republicans. They don't like the bill. It doesn't have enough border guards in it. And they don't like the money for Ukraine. So it's stalled right now. The ranking member, the next in line, the Democrat, Hakeem Jeffries, represents Brooklyn, majority people of color. He's takes a tremendous amount of money from the American Israel Public Affairs Committee. And he's, wait, I'm going to introduce a discharge petition. We just need a majority of the House. And if Mike Johnson, that's the guy, the House Speaker, if he doesn't want a vote, I'll push it to the floor. Well, we need a lot of pressure on Hakeem Jeffries. But meanwhile, Biden is frustrated. What's he doing? He is wishing that he could circumvent this whole process and just send more weapons to Israel. He's already twice bypassed required congressional notifications to send hundreds of millions of dollars of lethal weapons to Israel. He wants to continue to do this, although now I think he feels he must notify Congress. So just the other day, I read a letter written by Tim Kaine, senator from Virginia, who sits on two very powerful committees in the Senate, Senate Armed Services, Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And it was a letter to Biden saying, look, you know, I'm really concerned about these weapons that you want to send to Israel. These are not defensive, quote, unquote, weapons. This is not for the Iron Dome. Just this is for a lot of things. That and look at all the people who are dying in Gaza, of course. And then he went on about October 7th. But for Tim Kaine to write that letter to Biden, Biden has to take note of that. And what it says to me is this guy is totally gaslighting everybody.
Yeah, and I think that, and Channing, this may be the section we want to use actually in terms of the most bite for it, is I start all my work, Marcy, accepting how weak I am and how weak we are. I do. And then I get hopeful based on that assessment of the truth. And then I try to figure out, all right, if we're relatively weak and they're relatively strong, what are their vulnerabilities and what are our strengths? I look at better that way, you know, and then I get my optimism up and I say, all right, so what are our strengths? And I think right now, and we're both interested in saying the same thing, destabilizing the Biden campaign is the primary thing that the movement can do in every single way, because we're not powerful enough to figure out the outcomes, but we know this man cannot be allowed to have a rosy path to the Democratic nomination. And I'd say to everybody, this is not the time to worry about Trump. I mean, there's a man committing mass murder right now. And then I had one other thought. The real president of the United States is Benjamin Netanyahu, because Netanyahu has more power in Congress than Joe Biden does. He controls both sides of the House. So when Joe Biden says, you know, I'm a little worried about some of the murder. And he goes, Who the hell are you? Go back to where the hell you came from. I get to give a speech in Congress when Obama was president. And what I'm getting to is Israel is the monster that the United States created. And now that monster controls the United States. What do you think?
Well, I don't think you'd have a hard time convincing me of that. However, I do think the people have power, right? And if we understand how much power we had, we would be more powerful. And so these Democratic politicians, like Ted Lieu in West LA, who was one of, what, 46 Democrats who stepped out of line to vote for $17.5 billion in weapons for Israel. This bill did not pass because it needed a two-thirds. It was under some sort of procedural rule. But he, as well as Adam Schiff, right, who is running for Senate, both supported this. And I just think that we need to encourage and join with grassroots people all over who are bird-dogging these politicians, these Democratic and Republican Party politicians. And that's one of the things, you know, I'm not in Washington, but Medea Benjamin, our co-founder, is Jody Evans, another co-founder, was recently there. And they have been bird-dogging these politicians, these lawmakers. They put them on Instagram. Susan Sarandon joined them and confronted, are you for a ceasefire? Why? Why not? Why not? Tell me. You know, oftentimes these lawmakers, they want to dodge them, hide, but once in a while, they'll turn and speak. And the Code Pink delegation, it's now about, I don't know, 30 people who meet on a daily basis on Capitol Hill. And they've been plastering these offices, the outside of these offices, with documents detailing how much money these politicians are taking from APAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, basically exposing them. So, you know, it's all good. I mean, it's all very important. And in my own congressional district, we have a right-wing Democrat, former Marine, father was a farm worker. How far this guy has fallen? Salud Carbajal. He votes for every near trillion-dollar military budget, voted to define anti-Semitism, anti-Zionism as anti-Semitism, voted to send cluster bombs to blow off the limbs of children in Ukraine, and on, opposes an audit of the Pentagon, sits on the House Committee overseeing military spending, takes $73,000 from the military contractors. So we have our work cut out for us. I am campaigning for Elena Pascarella, and she's running in the primary. And I don't know if we have time. There's one other.
Well, I want to say one thing. We have time.
Okay. You know, when you talk about strategy, strengths, I do think one of our strengths points to our youth, right? The youth. The kids are all right.
I do too.
They get it.
That's what I wanted to be more clear about. I'm saying that the primary tactic is to destabilize the Biden camp. The primary hopefulness is how many forces now have made Palestine, as Channing said, Palestine is our Vietnam for a new generation. And the risks that people are taking, you told me off the microphone that the UC Santa Barbara social justice clubs are being attacked, of course, the president of Harvard. But I see this as positive, which is the movement is so substantial right now, so threatening to the system, that instead of ignoring it, they're moving to repress it, which in return, historically, has generated at least a lot more resistance. That's been my experience. So I'm genuinely optimistic as a very long-term view. I think when Prince William speaks out against the massacre, and Biden and Netanyahu doesn't know what to do because he can't attack the future king of England, there are splits taking place on the other side. I'm not trying to overstate it, but I think the work that Code Pink does is another of the very optimistic things. So you end with the three most optimistic other things on your mind. conversation here.
I'll just recap what we talked about. I think
abandon
Biden is central. That's the core. That's what we should focus on. Totally delegitimizing his reelection, not putting a seal of approval on genocide, and pointing out that he has been a danger on multiple fronts, not just Gaza. His foreign policy, you know, I'll say this. I was a Bernie delegate in 2020, and we launched a petition. Biden, fire your foreign policy team. We saw the writing on the wall that this guy was bringing in people who had no clue.
Optimism. Remember optimism.
Okay, anyway. So the optimism is that we are building a movement, that we are going to delegitimize Biden and therefore end this genocide. We are going to mobilize people in the swing states not to vote for him. Because if you don't take that risk, you're never going to get anywhere. I feel, you know, if you don't use your power, you will never get anywhere. So that's
you
one.
You have the last word. That's the first.
Okay, that's another one. Number two, we talked about the youth, supporting our youth, being in solidarity with them. They're being oppressed, suppressed, speaking out, but they are speaking truth to power. So that's fantastic. And then also, you know, other nations, the General Assembly, certainly Latin America is very hopeful. We have some progressive governments. I read, and I put it in the article, that Israel suspended arms shipments to Latin America after the president of Colombia, who used to be a Marxist guerrilla, denounced what Israel's doing as analogous to what Hitler did.
Right.
So let's look to Latin America. Nicaragua. Nicaragua has already submitted a declaration of intervention in support of South Africa. Bolivia may be next. So let's support them and look to them for guidance as well.
I'll just add a fourth,
which is what you said, is all power to South Africa for such a courageous and effective international intervention. So I think what we're all saying is that in the face of genocide, no one is looking for facile hope, but there really is hope. That's what we're saying, is there really is hope. This is splitting the whole world apart. Splitting whole countries apart, political parties apart. There are people quitting the Pentagon. There are people quitting the State Department. The brother just set himself on fire as the first of, you know, Philip Morrison did it in the war of Vietnam. I think as an organizer, as we are against genocide, I do feel hope, Marcy, and I do think your work gives me hope.
Thank you so much, Eric. And together, we're going to continue to work and strategize because we can't afford not to, right?
Code Pink and the Strategy Center, Marcy and Eric, Channing, we're going to make some good stuff happen. Thanks, everybody. This is, again, Eric Mann on Voices from the Frontlines. Okay, so hey, everybody, in terms of me and you singing along, there's a wonderful song called Stand By Me, you know, by Benny King. But on the Playing for Change album and the Playing for Change DVD, they have a longer version where there are people from all over the world playing, and I'm going to sing along with that one. Okay, so with that, they'll start and I'll follow.
This song says, no matter who you are, no matter where you go in your life, at some point you're going to need somebody to stand by you. Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. Oh my darling, stand by me. No matter who you are, no matter where you go in life, you're gonna need somebody to stand by you. No matter how much money you got, all the friends you got, you're gonna need somebody to stand by you. When the night has come and the land is dark and that moon is the only light we see, no, I won't be afraid. No, I won't shed one tear. Just as long as you think stand by me. Darling, darling, stand by me. Oh, stand by me. Oh, stand. Stand. Stand by me.
Come on, stand by
me. Stand by me.
Yeah.
When the sky that we look upon might be troubled and fall. On the mountains, they should tumble into the sea. I won't cry, I won't cry,
I won't
shed a tear, just as long as you stand by me. So darling, darling, stand by me. Oh, stand by me. Please stand by me. Stand by me.
And darling, darling,
stand by me.
Oh, stand by me.
Please stand. Stand by me. Stand by me. Oh, baby, baby.
Well, you heard them. Please stand by me. Stand by us as we transition to the next conversation. The first conversation you heard was, again, a conversation between Eric Mann and Marcy Winograd, and they're talking about her article, How Nations Could End Israeli Genocide, Stop the Weapons, Stop the Oil, and Stop the Tech. And as you heard from them, they're talking about Abandon Biden, a really great conversation, especially that we're hearing the second half of this conversation. The first half we heard last week, or otherwise known as before the elections, before the primary. And this segment of the conversation we're hearing after the election and after the primary. And now you can see how many people went with the tactic of abandoning Biden in this election. And we always love this song, Stand By Me. This version of Stand By Me is not, obviously, you know, it's not the Ben E. King version, but it is the version that is sung and produced by Songs Around the World, or Song Around the World. And you can find a copy of that on YouTube. If you've ever seen it on YouTube, you see how they just spotlight, I don't know how many musicians from all around the world. Musicians that played and did music and did cultural work during the apartheid South Africa. You see indigenous drummers. You see, you know, the Black South sort of starting off the song in the very fashion that, you know, Black folks here in the United States started off by rebelling against slavery and built a whole international movement during the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. It's such a beautiful song. I love hearing it all the time. But I digress, because the next segment of this show is going to be a reflection on this night in conversation and film night around Americon with Chris Smalls and Sean Claffey. As I mentioned at the beginning of the show, we had this film showing. And while we're not going to play the film for you on Voices, obviously, I want you to go to americond.com in order to find ways that you can view this film. What we are going to play here on Voices is all the conversations that we had around and in between the film. And the first piece of this that you're going to hear is that we watched a 5-minute clip from Tiger by the Tail, and that's a film produced by the Strategy Center, and it is around this campaign to keep GM Van Nuys open. And we played that because it's such an important piece about grounding this film Americond and the movement around Amazon Workers Union in the historical fight to, you know, always fight for the human rights and civil rights of Black and Latinx workers through the building of unions. And so the first piece of what you're going to hear is Eric talking about this clip in Tiger by the Tail. And I won't say much more about it. I can give you a whole essay about it because I love it, but he'll tell you about that. Then we go to mainly Acuna and Chris for the second piece of that, the clips. And both Acuna and Chris are responding and reflecting on the film. And as you'll hear all of their chemistry going back and forth, how they're sharing experiences and the struggle as both of them, you know, are learning to wage revolution against the system, as we all are. I believe it was such a beautiful night. You had to be there. But, you know, your primer is you get to listen to these clips, about 20 minutes of conversation around this film, around movement building and challenging notions and challenging the film, but also praising the film, right? Because it was a great film. And the thing I'll end with is, besides this, we also did live stream the panel after the film. And so what you're hearing is the audio version, but you can always go to instagram.com/fightsoulcities, and you don't have to have an Instagram account. You can just go right to that website, and it will show the video from our live stream, and you can see the actual facial expressions, and you'll see the whole conversation, which includes also Eric Mann and Sean Claffey. And with that, let's play the clip.
Thank you all for having us tonight. It's been a great trip here to the West Coast. ever since 2020, this is like my second home, so I'm happy to be back in company with y'all and share space with y'all tonight. And yeah, y'all watched the journey tonight really before it really took off. You know, you saw scenes with my children, with my little puppy, and I was living in one of the most impoverished neighborhoods in New Jersey, probably one of the most in the country, is Newark, New Jersey. Same thing, just like Compton, South Central over here, where the life expectancy for a black man is 25. Actually, during filming this movie, I wouldn't even want them feel comfortable of them coming to my house because it was that dangerous to even film me. So to earn that trust and really bond and build that relationship, it was really difficult because I was caring about everybody's safety, even the camera crew. And because going to work and organizing at Amazon, I had to commute 3.5 hours each way from that same neighborhood of Newark, New Jersey. And let me tell you, I was 31 years old and I lived in Newark for 2 years and I've never seen as much crime in those 2 years in my entire life. I'm talking about every week somebody was dead either in the front of my house or in the back of my house. I think one time I went to pick up my food from DoorDash and there was a shootout right in front of me where I could have been easily killed by a stray bullet. There's plenty of times when there were shootouts or memorials right on the same block where I lived. I was in the South Ward, in the worst part of the whole entire city. And to do that and still get up and organize after being fired, people would never know what I had to go through. That's something that also I had to overcome, was just the fear of going outside and organizing. So when Amazon fired me, and I said this earlier in a workshop at Trade Tech, when somebody asked me, what is real power? Well, let me tell you this. At the time this film was being shot in 2020, Jeff Bezos was the number one richest man in the world. He was making $13 billion a day, $9 million an hour, almost $5,000 a second. So when you want to know his power, he spent $9 million talking about Chris Smalls, who spoke and got fired in New York. Somebody who makes less than $50,000. And then on top of that, the day they fired me, I cost Amazon $4 billion alone because they had to hand deliver the PPE that they didn't give us during COVID to my building the next day. So if you ask me what power looks like, that's power when you speak the truth. And from that day forward, I made that decision that I'm going to continue to organizing because they said to make me the face of the whole unionizing movement. So it's a good idea.
I have a couple questions. By the way, Chris, I lived at 212 Chadwick Avenue in the South Ward of Newark, where I organized with the Newark Community Union Project. So I want to ask you, Chris, as an organizer, you know that campaigns go through phases and stages, and you accomplish this and they set back. Where are you now in the campaign? What are your goals and objectives? How can we help? The strategy said it is making a contribution to both the Amazon Labor Union and the distribution of this film and wants to help. So maybe you could tell us a little bit as an organizer, what's going on? You won this. What's the next goal? How are you going to win some contracts? And what can we do to help? And then I'll come in and ask you some questions.
Absolutely, yeah. After we won, Amazon spent 9 months objecting to the victory. Even after we made American history and beat them against all the odds and the $14.5 million they spent in 1 year, putting all of my workers in captive audiences just like this over 3,000 times, within that time frame. Even after that, they still had 25 objections to the election. The $1 trillion company.
Sounds so familiar.
Right. So, fortunately, we have an excellent legal team. All women, by the way. All three of my lawyers are women, women of color. And they kicked their asses again, legally, and all of the 25 objections were dismissed. And we finally got certified as an official union. It wasn't even, it was a year after we won. So last year, in January, we got officially certified as a governing union. And what happens is, the fight starts all over again. But people in this country don't understand that, you know. Because of these weak federal laws, we should already have been at the table right after we beat them.
That's right, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me tell y'all now that we don't even have a bargaining order as I sit here right now.
Wow.
So that's not my fault. That's not my union's fault. That's these politicians, your favorite ones from Bernie Sanders on. That's these politicians that sit up in the White House that haven't changed these federal laws since the 1930s. Because we seen our president last year use the railroad strike from 1945 in 2023.
Yep.
But here we are as labor unions endorsing the man.
No.
Calling ceasefire on one side of the mouth, and then we endorse them. We be going on strike. We can strike all day and night. We can get these TAs and get these contracts for our memberships, which is great. But if there's no federal laws, that's not including the working class. And this is the reason why union density is still less than 10% in this country. So because of all of that, once again, not just Amazon, but Starbucks, Trader Joe's, Google, all of these things that happened in the last 2 years, none of us have a contract, none of us have a bargaining order right now. So we all need to be upset.
Yes.
And that's what we're dealing with right now. Two years after we won, we don't even have a bargaining order from the most progressive NLRB in history. That's what they claim.
Yeah.
Make it make sense.
You mentioning black women as women of color being on your group is reminding me of what Melina said before we started this program. And it was an invitation for black women to come to an event to be honored. And it threw me off because she said basically that our labor was unwelcome and that we were invited to be celebrated. And you are describing, and one of my best friends is from Newark, who's on the school board, so I know Newark very well. I'm from New York as well. You described a level of violence, right, in your neighborhood, a systematic violence. And then, with your second comment, you described another layer of violence, violence through policy, violence through law. And the reason why I went back to this event celebrating black women is because I think it kind of not made me uncomfortable, but it threw me off because this country is founded on the labor of black women, right? Like literally who we would birth. We were birthing workers, we were birthing slaves. So this country is built off of exploiting our labor. And so one thing that I appreciated about the film was showing how policies, you know, Reagan moving forward shows how unions were weakened, how the country wasn't working for all of America. But I also invite us to take a step back to remember that this country was never working for us. And that's something, you know, in the film, and again, Sean, I want to get back to you too, because I think there is a piece in this art that's so important that we do need to discuss in addition to the work, right? But there were some terms that kept coming up. Someone kept saying again, fair again, again. And I was like, when? And for whom?
That's right.
And I think this film is so important because it's an invitation to people who were comfortable ignoring the exploitation of Black and Indigenous labor that this country was founded on. And this film is an invitation for white folks who are now feeling what it's like, right? Because that's why they call us the miner's canary, because it's like, oh, well, you know, when Black people get a coal, when everyone else gets a coal, Black people have the flu. And so I want to just contextualize what I was thinking about when you were speaking, like just these layers of violence, and how, even though I appreciate the love, and I used to be a history teacher, so I really appreciated the facts, the connection to the politicians, really making it clear the way they were organizing, right? Because then the question is, well, how are we going to organize? So I appreciate that. But I also wanted to take that step back so that we could remember, well, this country is actually functioning really well. And one thing that struck me, and you designed this, so I want to hear from you about it, is as I was watching the film, I was thinking the police are so good at what they do. Throughout the film, you see, really, and you were one of the first interactions with the police when you're trying to organize, and you're like, ooh, I haven't seen them like that before. But in history, we've always seen them like that before. And then there was another scene where the folks are at risk of being evicted. So hard seeing those children. And we see the scene where the children are at risk of being evicted. And the police are there doing their job and doing it so well. And so I say all that to say that when you're describing these levels of violence that you're fighting against, I really want to share appreciation for your work, for your labor. And Sean, I also want to share appreciation because, and I don't know your personal background, so I won't guess, but it's a level of labor to listen to people's stories and to give them an opportunity to not feel shame and to be able to realize that their story is part of a greater quilt of exploitation and oppression. And the fact that even in making this film, you organized yourself because you were like, ooh, this wasn't a labor film, but then it had to be because you were willing to listen to the truth. And so I just want to say thank you, and I know I'm getting emotional.
That's all right.
Thank you. But I want to say thank you because a lot of filmmakers wouldn't have listened to the truth. There would have been filmmakers who would have just told the story that they set out to tell. And so I just want to, you know, honor that as an artist because, you know, that's a story that I relate to very deeply. And this is never something I've ever said aloud, but I feel a need to. I remember being evicted. And we didn't have a truck, we had to carry it out the house. And I remember that feeling of shame. And so, and that was when I was like a young teenager. And so then to now come as an adult and to be able to think about my experience and weave that within what folks were experiencing in Orlando, what folks were experiencing in other places, you know, that's a story that you told in a way that is palatable to folks. And so again, you know, what I'm thinking about is the story of exploitation and oppression, that's nothing new, and that's not something from even 50 or 60 years ago. And so what I'm grateful for is I feel like your film is an organizing tool to get the people who didn't know and maybe knew and didn't care. But now it's a shared oppression, and so what are we all going to do? And so really, I just want to say thank you, and it's weird that I'm even sitting next to you because I remember living here and watching the video of you popping the bottle, and I was like, oh, I wish I had a bottle. And so, you know, I just want to say thank you so much, and if you could maybe offer up some more detail about, you know, are there things going on that we should be doing? Like, what are the, you know, like, I'm sure you have a list of 3 to 5 things that you want everyone in this room to do and that you want us to then organize someone else to get them to help. So what are those, like, and I will take notes and it's being recorded. What do we need to do? And also, that's one question, but I think another question is, what do you need, right? Like in terms of guidance and where you are as a union. Like I know for me at USC, we just voted on amendments to a bylaw for our bylaw. So we're not even like able to function yet. Like we're literally like a baby union. And you're, to me, like a teenager, so I'm looking up to you like, okay, what do we do? But then I know you're a teenager looking up to, you know, union giants of, okay, well, what have you done? And learning from those lessons. So I'm wondering if you could maybe go back and talk about what you need, but then also maybe like look forward of like, you know, what lessons or wisdom or like what questions do you have that folks can maybe like help with? And I know that was a lot, but this is a lot, so here we go.
Well, first I want to say thank you for sharing that, because there's nothing to be ashamed about being evicted, because you're looking at somebody. I was evicted four times in my life. I was evicted four times. I was homeless, living out of my car for a whole summer. So I've been there. And once again, at 31 years old, I lost everything being fired from Amazon. So I had no other choice but to organize. And, you know, as I sit here right now, my father is still incarcerated. You know, he's still incarcerated. He's been there since 1988, since the year I was born. So, you know, people don't, these are the stories people don't hear about me, but I love to share them because, you know, my mother being a strong black woman and me watching her as the oldest kid in the house, that's where I got my fight from, you know? So, you know, you have to be built for these type of movements. And what billionaires and the 1% will never understand is how it is to be a black man in America or a black woman. And, you know, what we can all do is speak truth to power. And what happened to me can happen to anybody. I guess that's why a lot of people related to my story. And what I say now is, you know, we don't organize, we're not going to get anything. This is what I've learned in my short journey. You know, 4 years ago, I didn't know any of this. And 2 years ago, less than 2 years, I was a union president that I would have never fathomed. So I'm learning every day. You know, I'm learning every day. I'm learning everywhere I go, everywhere I travel. I'm like a sponge right now. And what I've seen is that even in this country, even all the good things that's going on, that we're still very much divided, super divided. Because if I can sit here right now, shout out to April Sims, I asked this crowd earlier, I said, how many black presidents do you know on a national level? Right. So and if you can say you only know Chris Smalls, that is a problem. And how many black women are in head of these unions? That's a problem. So even within labor, the representation is not there. And it's not even on a national level, it's on an international level as well. And that's what I learned in my short 2.5 years of journey, because guess what? I just got my passport last year. And the first place I went to was where, Mark?
Cuba.
That's right. To end the embargo, the 60-year inhumane embargo. First U.S. delegation for labor. And taking the stances that I take, I get a lot of grief all the time. People talk shit all the time about me. The things I do, the places I go, the people I'm connected with. But I don't care. Because I know what we've been getting in America, we've been duped for decades. And these politicians, the ones I met, even Biden, the ones I shook hands with, the ones I sat right next to, The biggest mistake was letting me in that White House because they didn't do a good background check.
All right, folks, you know the deal. As Nina Simone says, we did it our way, not the imperialist way. But what she means by that is we're building institutions for Black liberation. We're building institutions for third world liberation. We're building institutions to fight for our view. And you know that we're building the institution of KPFK. And that is a collective manner. And so we need your help. We need you to call 818-985-5735. And let me put it a different way. It is our responsibility as believers in a whole alternative world, opposite of imperialism, to then build our own institutions and do as much collective work as we can to make sure they are sustained. That means it's your duty to get on the phone and call 818-985-5735 to give a contribution to make sure that KPFK survives. And if you're unable to make a call right now, you can always go to www.kpfk.org. Let's do it our way, like Nina Simone has prescribed, and follow directions from Black women during Women's History Month or Women's Revolutionary Liberation Month. Let's call 818-985-5735 to give to KPFK. As always, we love hearing from you. We want to get your feedback to this show and other shows. You can email either myself or Eric, Channing at voicesfromthefrontlines.com or Eric at voicesfromthefrontlines.com. This show and all of our previous shows will be archived on our website, voicesfromthefrontlines.com, and on our podcast. You can search us in your favorite podcasting platform. Just search voicesfromthefrontlines.com and like the post if it's available and leave a comment on the post if it's available. All of that helps out the show. And did I mention calling 818-985-5735? I think I mentioned that. You're going to call. I hope, I have faith that you're going to give to KPFK even though we're not in fund drive. And with that, we'll see you next week, hear you next week. We'd love to hear from you. All power to the people.
What is a man? What is he got? If not himself, then he has not to say the things he truly feels.